What's good, Podcastville? Thank you for 15 incredible seasons. Big shout out to Sound Reaper Graphics and Blue Canary Auto for 5 years of consistent support of the Bystander Podcast. I am your host, Tiny Tim, coming to you from beautiful Bainbridge Island, Washington, at some generic time in your day. I'm glad you're here. Please be a friend and tell a friend you heard it on the Bystander and follow us on social media. Now let's get the party started with some intro music from the incredible Leroy Bell. What's good, Podcastville? You found the Bystander Podcast. Today on the podcast, I have author, among other things, the author of a book called A Mother's Courage to Awaken, Dr. Paula Petrie. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks for toe-tapping to the music. I love that. Leroy Bell is a good friend and an artist that comes here to the island that plays the summer concert series almost every year. I hope you can catch him out this summer. So tell me, what brought you from Miami to our neck of the woods?
Well, I something told me to go to the most beautiful area in the country.
Nice.
So I would say mostly that. It's definitely very, very beautiful here. And I love the aspect of the nature, but also the ruggedness of the Pacific Northwest and the animal life and it's the strong presence of Native American voice and presence, heritage that exists here that I haven't experienced anyplace else in the world. So,
very cool. How'd you hear about it in the first place?
Actually, through foundation work that I was part of, and they were based out of Seattle, and I was part of that and heard about it, and that drew me here.
And Tell everybody what you were doing in Miami.
Well, in Miami, I through my daughter's life, everything has been informed through my daughter, Alexandra. And she was born in the Dominican Republic as we were living there at the time. We moved to Miami shortly after her birth. She was born with a significant disability, spina bifida. And I got invited to be part of a parent-to-parent movement, and I ended up founding and leading a nonprofit organization called Parent to Parent in Miami. And that was helping and still does, helps 5,000 families every year, and that was in 1986. And it's ongoing, and it has federal and local funding, and it was the notion that was new then, but now we know that's just so much research supporting the idea that one peer having gone forward and being able to achieve something successfully has a very powerful influence over others that are in that same walk of life. So we began by supporting matching parents who had this child with the same disability. And that's how, and then we became more of an advocacy as well as that, but advocacy and helping families understand the legal, especially through special education, what their rights were, but also the financial piece and how to qualify and if they do. So it's really, now they have 12 navigators. And so I was very part of that for being part of my life. I helped pass legislation. And then I became such a strong voice in the state and somewhat at the national level that the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Miami has a specialized program for children with disabilities funded through the Kennedy administration. And they reached out to me and said, we'd like to bring you on board and bring in that family voice perspective, family-centered care practices into our medical school. And I was there for 12 years. And in that process, my own desire to have a PhD blossomed. And it was kind of like, if they can do it, I can too. So I got my PhD in education in 2000. What year was that? Oh, gosh, 2007. And I'll say, Timothy, life goes on. And if for people, younger, you're never too old. I received my diploma, right, my doctoral degree at age 55.
Wow.
And I it was something I always wanted to do. And so I did it. And
congratulations.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, when somebody gets the news that they're about to birth or birth a child with special needs, how do you go about spiritually and holistically helping the mindset? And you talked about finances and a few other things there. Mm-hmm. How do you emotionally put somebody back together if they're in a wreck and devastated by that type of news?
Yeah, it's, what people need with grief, that's a tremendous grief, right? Because it's a grief of, we don't recognize it at the time, but it helps to help families frame it this way, because there's the dream child, and that's the loss of the dream. So it's really a grieving process and helping families feel okay with that grieving process. If the child's particularly born, and it all varies, right? But so the dream has to be recognized as something that was there, but it was an illusion. So Joseph Campbell has this great message for all of us, right? You have to live the life that you've been given, or accept the life you've been given in order to live life. It's because you can't, otherwise you stay in that grief forever. So it's acceptance of what is, and everything else was an illusion, which is really hard to, I've come to know that much later and more with a spiritual practice than I had at that time. But there's what we conjure up for what we want our life to be or expect it to be. Mm-hmm. But we have to be in the moment and then accept what is. And because this is life. The rest was a dream, was something we conjured up in our mind and that we expect to have. Mm-hmm. So we need to let go of those expectations. And we do that. So what helps? The experts in grief say that we need one good listener, non-judgmental listener. I step into this, I still get emotional, but...
Yeah, take your time.
Yeah, because it's our own judgment on everything in life that creates so much havoc for us, right? Our own self-punishment. So, as mothers, I lived it, and I've helped I've helped thousands of people through this. But it's, where did I go wrong? What did I do wrong? What should I have done differently? Yeah. And so that's the non-judgmental listener, right? And so we trained parents to be non-judgmental listeners. It's hard. It's a tough job, right? Because and not to give solutions, but really that empowerment model is helping people. It's like life coaches now are kind of everywhere, right? But the 80s and 90s, we were the life coaches, right?
Yeah, and they were different. It was like Tony Robbins and right. Mr. Wu on the boat or whatever his name was. Be rich like me.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But that's another preconceived notion about what we should be or who we should be, or Prince Charming's going to come sweep me off my feet. That's a bit of a fantasy as opposed to the reality, and finding our real self is difficult. It's a work in progress, at least for me. When you found out the information, how did you heal yourself? Would you say you're still healing?
Primarily, I think we're always healing and evolving and coming to understand ourselves from a new perspective, right? Writing my book helped me heal a whole lot because it's a memoir. So you bring up all the memories and you tell yourself, you understand it from a different now point of view, right? And so you're rewriting your story. You write the truth of it, but what's happening emotionally inside of you is that you're healing in that story that you're writing because now you have more distance from it and you are the writer, not you're living it per se. So writing my book was a big healing process. I think at the time, actually helping others, so much good research on this type of thing. And if you get out of your own misery by helping others, right? It's all religions tell us to do that, all spiritual practices, yeah. Right?
And it deflects, right?
Yeah.
Gets your mind on something else.
And you find purpose and meaning. That's really David Kessler's work on grief is the sixth stage of grief. We had five stages through Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and the sixth stage of grief coming forth from David Kessler, who actually worked with Elizabeth Ross for a long time, is finding meaning and purpose. So founding, you know, the nonprofit and helping others just gave me so much meaning and purpose in my life. And so it was like, well, this good is coming out from this. In fact, disability is a beautiful teacher.
Wow. Thank you for sharing. And thank you for bringing in the book for me as well. I'm looking forward to reading it. You were recently in the Wellness Online Blossom event 2 weeks ago. I appreciate you jumping in on that. How did that go for you?
Oh, now I want to call Charlie Blossom when I see her. But Mayla Blossom, I always want to see. She's just like this blossoming flower of goodness. And it was wonderful to be part of a community here. So that's a big part because I've only been here a year or so to be a contributor is good.
I saw you had done something with Sonia as well about creating calm during chaos with kids. Can you articulate a little bit about that?
Yeah. I moved here as a kind of spontaneous. I ended up in someone's guest home. Someone knew somebody and that kind of thing. And then I ended up in this beautiful little piece of beauty here in Bainbridge Island. And another friend said, oh, I worked with someone, Sonia Fritz. Maybe you'd like to meet her. And she had done a lot of training in heart math. And so we met. I was here like a month and I'm meeting Sonia Fritz. And she was very involved in her own children's education and background. So we put together a chaos to calm for middle schoolers, for high schoolers as well. But what blossomed for us, speaking of blossom, this past year was so fascinating. Timothy, we started with two girls. One of them was Sonia's daughter, and she brought a friend, and they called themselves our test rats, and they were doing us the biggest favor in the whole world by showing up to, showing up to class. Maybe not exact all details, but by second, third class, they had brought more friends. They were no longer test rats. And then 14 or 15 weeks later, we just finished our last class last week. And they're like, what are we doing this summer? And then this is, you can imagine, these are middle school girls. And we said, okay, what do you want us to do different in the fall? Yeah, it's like we soothe anxiety by letting them know, yeah, we're all getting back together and we'll be here in the fall. And they said, no, we want the class longer. Like Sonia and I looked at each other like, okay, we'll add length.
So were the kids coming there to seek relief from anxiety, or what was the purpose of the class, and how did the children gravitate towards it?
Yeah. It's a very experiential class. So they did come. It was clearly, and the parents, all of our materials are talk about dealing with anxiety and stress. And kids, teens have a lot of anxiety and stress right now. It's over the top. So
what were some of the, sorry to interject in your answer here, but what were some of the things that teens were stressed about the most?
You know, relationships is on the board big time. Relationships and how to navigate relationships and also home environments. Homes can be are stressful. Everyone's stressed and parents are stressed, and so when you couple the layers of stress, it's overwhelming for youth because they don't have the one thing we share with them is that their own emotional capacity and their brains on stress, you know, are work together in such a way that they can end up perceiving life that this hard time is going to last forever. They don't have that sense of time because of their youth, right? And then with the neuroscience, we know that the brain isn't fully developed until age 25. And so they have part of that prefrontal cortex, you know, planning and perception piece that's not yet developed. And so the overwhelm can happen. And so we see that in suicide rates. So that was part of our real discussion. I worked with another young man. I work individually as well. He lives in Bolivia. And I worked with him after his attempted suicide. And he jumped from the third floor window of his high school last November. And luckily, he landed in such a way that his body received quite a bit of damage, but his head was landed on grass. We just say, it's like a thank God for that. And what he shares, and now I'm going to be doing a podcast with him later this month, and because his message to youth is part of what I just shared, is that he was so distressed and distraught over some social interactions that had happened. But with working with him, those social interactions, which were no one's paying attention to me, blaming himself, I'm not getting my point across, they're ignoring me. When we tracked it back in time in his own memory field, it was an old story he was telling himself. It's a childhood story. And so that story was getting retold and re-experienced. And couple that with what's going on with the teen and just external pressures and anxieties in the whole world, right? Like, we don't live independent of everything, you know, that's part of what we teach. There's an information field. We're all interconnected. You know, the Native Americans, indigenous people have it right, and that there is a quantum connecting field. And so teens know this. You children know this. We just keep denying that reality enough that we come by adulthood, we totally forget it. So what's going on in our home, but in our school, in our neighborhoods, and on the news is all having an influence on us. And so he got to the point where the pressure was so great, and he chose to, made that decision to try to end his life. Recent CDC came out, Timothy, 2 months ago now, with the latest report that should scare everybody, but particularly for girls, because what they found was that 25% of girls in the United States, teen girls, have made a suicide plan. And the LGBTQ community of girls, 22% last year attempted suicide. 14% of girls.
And how's that rate versus boys?
Boys is significantly less in all of these.
But they're more successful, correct? Because they usually use guns as opposed to pills. And
Yeah. For suicide rate, boys are more successful than girls. We're tying this into, you know, social media. So we talk about social media with the girls, with Chaos to Calm, as you know, is a factor in their lives, particularly for girls, because, you know, socially, what other people think of us, just in the way our culture has been designed, you know, our beliefs and values within our culture, what other people think of us defines who we are, much less than for boys. So when Facebook and the other social medias, particularly when Facebook in 2009 created the like button, I mean, it created chaos. Yeah. Emotional chaos.
I think kids have picked up on that too. There's not as much liking of posts anymore. It's just you view it and move on, you know, because that was detrimental. Kids thinking, oh, my post isn't good enough. I need more likes, or I'm not as popular, not as cool as the next person because they have more likes. And it was a game of collecting likes.
Yes.
But they're false likes. It doesn't mean somebody likes you and the inner you. Now, you call yourself, besides an author and presenter, and energy practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that, because I thought you were going that way a little bit.
Yeah.
What does that mean in your definition?
Yes. Well, energy medicine is the acknowledgement that we have the power to direct energy. And for healing purposes. So if you're in energy medicine, it means that you're directing energy for the purpose of healing, affecting another person's well-being.
So is that positive energy, or you plug me into the light socket?
I know.
What is energy?
I know. Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, I wish I would have, I dive into all of this and I thought, oh, gosh, I wish I would have paid more attention in science class, right? But Einstein, if we go back to Einstein and people, you know, that everything is energy and everything has a vibration to it. And we're really sound and vibration light beings. That's how that's our primary composition, right? So, and quantum field. So we have an electromagnetic field. We can measure that. Scientists have measured that. There's no woo-woo about an electromagnetic field. We know Mother Earth has electromagnetic field, right? So we connect in with the Earth. That's why earthing, this forest bathing, is so good, because we are connecting into
Hold on. Forest bathing? What is that?
It's just spending time. It's just, you know, but it's actually a term that comes from a Japanese culture and tradition of spending time in the forest, in with nature, just surrounded by nature. And a couple things happen is that we our electromagnetic field connects up with that of Mother Earth. And so we have a lot of extra positive molecules, charged molecules. Mother Earth is divinely designed that has lots of negative ions. So we're out there in nature, and what happens is that neutralizes. So our positives that we always had, you know, this is something that took place for hundreds of thousands. Like, we just grew from, we have to remember where we came from, right? So we've always had this natural design, our divine design, and with Mother Earth, like, we're colluding together, right? She colludes with us always on our behalf. If we had only, listen and tune in and remember who we are. So the negative and the positive ends up having this very positive neutralizing effect on our bodies. It stimulates what we call the parasympathetic system. So that's a lot of my work is around the vagus nerve. And forest bathing means that you're spending time in the forest. And there's more to do with the Schumann resonance and this aspect of that helps also to bring calm to the body. And then if we really get connected, you know, we can commune. It's the understanding as well. Now I have, it's part of energy medicine. Typically people in energy medicine realize that all beings are sentient beings. There's a consciousness. And so you connect with the trees and the flowers and the earth.
Okay. You didn't lose me. I'm with you still.
I know.
Tonal chanting. Is that part of your forest bathing process? Because you do some chanting, correct?
I do. And toning is making vowel sounds, seven different vowel sounds that are associated with the energy body of the body, the energy system. So you doing that in the forest is wonderful as well. That also is another means to activate the vagus nerve. So I just developed and created this incredible unit actually now for teachers, parents, students on the vagus nerve. It's been adopted by an organization, a wellness certification board in actually the UK. And people are going to be able to get certified using my course on the vagus nerve around holistic health. And also by the Psychiatric Rehabilitation Association. So I hope to bring this into the school system because it's not, it's the science is the science of purely of the body.
So where is that nerve located in the body?
Yeah, it's amazing. That's it starts in the brainstem, wraps around the cochlear because the cochlear has to do with the importance of and the benefits of music and toning, making sounds, any vocalization of sound.
So
singing.
The back of your neck up around your ears?
Yep, yep. And then it extends and it wraps around every single organ in the body other than the adrenal glands. And it's important in the gut ends in through the gut.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when we activate it or tone the vagus nerve, we can do that many different ways. I teach five. What happens is that we turn off our fight or flight, which is all the kids are living in this fight or flight. Like, when is the next
shoe? I'd say the majority of people.
The whole world, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Post-COVID, we didn't, like, getting back to normal, no. We're not back to normal. We have more rage, more random violence, more, it's all that we haven't reset.
But is it possible that that's the new normal now?
Well, I think we're coming to accept, Timothy, that's absolutely right. We're coming to accept that we're not going back and that we need to do something to reset.
Because I see these mass shootings happening every day. There's been more gun deaths, and it's the leading killer of kids now, not disease. And I don't see reform or change coming. It seems to be like you can't pay enough attention to one child's death before another child dies. And it's much like the news. People are just tuning it out. And that's not the answer. So I don't know how we heal and go back to that previous normal when it just continues to amplify.
No, I think it's a crucial question. There was a great interview of Sharon Hoover's, the National Center of School Mental Health. She's the co-director, and asking about the teen mental health crisis. And she said that this is a crisis that we can't therapize our way out of it. We can't treat our way out of it. That it's a public health model that it's needed in order to address it. So that's my my desire was to bring this information of how to reset and continue to reset our fight or flight, activating our parasympathetic, our digest and rest and digest system into schools, because I do feel that it addresses it from a public health model. It's accessible to everybody, and it's all within us. We are our own instruments of healing, along with the earth.
Therapize. That was a good word. I hadn't heard that one before. Hey, how do we get a combination of Western medicine and holistic medicine to work together? I know I'm really frustrated with the American health system for numerous reasons, but one being just the fix as opposed to the prevention aspect. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. If you don't have 12 cigarettes a day, you're probably not going to get lung cancer. So let's promote the non-smoking, right? How do we get proper food in our body? You know, how do we continue to make people exercise? Because right now it seems like there's a lot of drug pushing, you know, and, mm-hmm. and so it be, whether it be oxycodone or fentanyl, it leads to other issues.
Yes.
You know, and it looks, our ocean here, you know, most of the fish are contaminated with some type of methamphetamine here in the Puget Sound, and it's sad. So question to you would be, how do we merge holistic and Western medicine together?
Yeah. Functional medicine is one came out in the 90s. Mark Hyman was the first president of the Functional Medicine Association. So functional medicine, I think, was our first blending of traditional medicine with holistic medicine. And so looking for a functional medicine practitioner is my suggestion in terms of individuals. You know, how can we be asking and finding answers beyond what traditional medicine is going to do? I see a naturopath, Dr. Willie here, for example, on the island. I get very different kind of blood tests that I would through a traditional medicine checkup. So for individually, I think there's those practitioners that we can reach out to and find solutions, because they look at the cause in a very different way than traditional medicine. And the pillars of, for example, I'm a partner with Global Wellness Transformation. There's many of these, but just to give you an idea that this individual who was healed by a functional medicine practitioner was a billionaire who decided that he would take a couple of his billions and put it into holistic health, because he found it like so phenomenal what he learned from his own healing process. And so he's creating, this was a recent launch of Global Wellness Transformation. I'm a partner with them. So there's many of those things going on that we can't necessarily see, but they're there. There's rising up of holistic health practitioners. We saw that, you know, but through the blossom, right? Mm-hmm. How many wonderful practitioners on all different parts of ourselves and coming at it from the holistic perspective.
Whether it be Reiki or yoga or whatever.
Yes.
It was a good, what would you call it? What would you call blossom?
Well, it was wonderful because it was an initiative to raise money for Turkey and Syria, yeah. Right? It's a holistic health model that comes through coming together online, which makes it global and
so
everybody
a webinar,
could reach
maybe.
It. It's a webinar.
Webinar.
Yeah. Yes.
I was trying to find the word. I
Got
just
it.
Could not. How does holistic medicine and learning holistic ways help people with chronic pain and depression and things that they have just knocked people down?
Yeah.
Burnout, stress.
Yeah. You know, inflammation is one of the main, we're saying, is a contributor to all illness and disease right now, right? And stress causes inflammation. And so people living in chronic stress, which is the vast majority of people right now, they never bring that the body never comes back to homeostasis. And so there's a reaction within the body where that stress is seen and the body's reacting to it as if it were the outsider invading the system, and we have the same inflammation as a result of that. So inflammation is tied to all the chronic illnesses, you know, whether it's not the cause and there's not a direct causal. But so again, as people, that's my kind of my medicine is offering that. So ways in which, you know, the cold showers resets our central nervous system, actually. Wim Hof is somebody who's made it very famous, right? And the barrels and the ice, but we have the Puget Sound and cold
polar
lakes.
Plunge
and, the polar plunge. It resets, it reprograms,
I just read, because a lot of people are into the cold plunge and the heat. I'm more into the heat. But when you do the cold plunge, a lot of people just jump in the sauna or steam room right after. You get the benefit from getting out of the cold plunge and letting your body bring your temperature back up to normal before you get in there. So if you're hopping from one to one, there's a little non-fact-checked advice from Tiny Tim.
That excellent. Absolutely. And we burn fat in doing that too. We get some, the brown fat cells got start burning them. And in
yeah,
a reaction
I don't know anything
to cold,
about fat.
Right? I don't either. Let's move on.
Yeah, I know you got
it. But acupuncture is another, there's many forms, right? So there's energy medicine, acupuncture, we look at diet.
Digging on me with a needle.
Those needles are so tiny, you don't
even
feel
them. Yeah, so I don't need
them.
So let's put them away. I'll just eat a salad, okay?
But the thing is that that's the Eastern meeting the Western, is that, the Chinese knew 5,000 BC, you know, about the energy system that runs invisibly in the body, and had mapped it totally out in the Red Book. So that's their medicine. And they even used, in India, there's an old image of an elephant with, you know, getting needled. So they're thinking to calm the nervous system, to cooperate in the, you know, tasks at hand, I guess you would say, with the elephants. So it's the Eastern is meeting the Western, and it's a huge collision right now. And the Southern medicine, we say the South, the medicine of the condor of the South, is the heart medicine, and it's coming, and it was prophesized to meet the eagle of the North, and the eagle being the mind. So we have the East meeting the West, the eagle and the condor, the mind and the heart meeting, and it's a huge collision right now. People are trying to define themselves and stake out territory. And we see the pharmaceuticals reacting almost like, yeah, you know, unconsciously, you know, like we're going to really carve out more and more space to take up as much of everybody's mind and body, spirit, you know, and to come into, I don't say control, but come into offer the solution through this mechanism only. So we see a lot of those battles going on, but it's all moving us to a higher understanding of who we are, and that is that we are mind, body, spirit. Anyone interested? Larry Doocy's book, now quite a few, maybe 10 years old, talks about the three eras of medicine, and we're in era three. We knew mind-body that came out in the 90s, while what we think creates our body reaction, right?
But mind-body and soul.
Mind-body and soul.
Sure. In your book, you talk about death and resurrection and emotional and mental wellness from the other side. Can you talk a little bit about what are the sides in your mind, and if you could talk about that a little bit. I don't want to preface the question too much. What is your belief in death and resurrection and talking between two sides?
Yes. So my daughter passed when she was 12 years old. It was tragic. It was unexpected. 11 years later, I was at the university. I was very much in the mind of academic, you know, traditional medicine. But I really felt that there was something better. I just knew it in my gut. Something just, you know. So I resigned my position to finish my PhD, and I sold my house the month before the 2007 crash, not knowing the crash was coming. And I had bought and sold well. So I took that money. I gave everything away. And I said, you know, I'm going to don't know. I did not have no idea what was next for me. I wanted to leave Miami. And in that pause where that darkness, that void is, and that we allow ourselves not to know, which is the most difficult part of life, came this opportunity to meet with a medium. And it was announced in a small group that I was in, all by fluke. And he had come from Georgia by fluke. And he was coming by fluke, we could say, or not, arriving on July 5th, which was the 11th anniversary of my daughter's death. She died on July 5th. And they said, who would like to meet with him? So that was like a no-brainer. So I said yes, and that was my first exposure to and answering my question. Because when you lose a child, it's very different. My mom's probably is transitioning soon. And the loss of a child is very different. You really have a quest to understand where do we go when we die. And I was Methodist, raised my children in the Methodist church. But I wasn't getting the answers there. And so sitting across from the medium that day, July 5th, 2007, I felt that something was, a truth was unfolding. And so being the scientist, I began to really delve into that. And I went from, and then the doors flew open. You know, people all with PhDs and MDs and, you know, oh, yeah, go see this person, go see that. It's an underground, it's like an underground network of millions of people, really. So I found my way into studying shamanic energy medicine. And with that, I wanted to immediately have that ability to help other people because I found so much relief and it began to make a lot of sense. And now I've studied the science of it. So meaning that energy never dies, energy leaves our body. In the form of, you would say, our soul, if we want to refer to it as soul or spirit, that part of us that lives on forever. Personality is retained. My daughter's come to me many times, but more easily is, now doing the work for others. It's not a large part of my work, but people come and often their loved one may appear and have a message, lots of conciliation, sharing.
So does that make you a shaman?
I'm going to leave shamans to
the shamans.
To the shamans. I find it very disrespectful to when people, neo-shamans would call it, that's even a term I don't like, but I find it disrespectful. There's no way we can... You know, it's very different.
Well, Paula, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. And Podcastville, go out and get A Mother's Courage to Awaken at Eagle Harbor Books now and Amazon and online. You can also learn more about Dr. Paula Petrie at paulapetrie.com, correct?
Yes.
All right. And that's P-E-T-R-Y. Thank you for your time, Paula. I look forward to having you in the community and talking to you again.
All right. Thank you so much, Timothy.
You've been
wonderful. Thank you.
Appreciate it. You've been listening to The Bystander. Be kind.